There's an episode of Fawlty Towers where Sybil has a couple of jobs that she wants her husband Basil to do. She wants him to type out the menu for that evening's meal in the hotel that they run together, and she also wants him to hang up a picture in the hotel's reception area. And so Basil is there sitting at the typewriter, dutifully working on the menu, and Sybil walks past and says, have you put up that picture yet, Basil? At that, Basil, kind of muttering under his breath, leaves the menu unfinished and fetches a hammer and a nail and starts mounting the picture. And he's in the middle of doing that when Sybil walks in again. Basil, we really do need that menu typed up, you know. So Basil, by now barely able to contain his irritation, slams the picture down and goes back to the typewriter. And so it goes on. Whichever task he's working on, Sybil is always concerned about the other one getting done. And as a viewer then, you enjoy the humour of the scene, but you also feel a bit sorry for this poor, harassed husband. And there's a character in our passage this evening that might similarly arouse our pity. It's a character whom Daniel encounters in the second half of the passage, the figure that he's in conversation with from verse 10 of chapter 10 onwards. And almost certainly, he's an angel. Quite possibly, this character is Gabriel again, whom we've encountered already in Daniel, although we can't say that for sure here because no name is mentioned. And as I say, we might well feel sorry for this character. In his case, there's no nagging wife, of course. But like Basil, this poor angel here is kind of being pulled in different directions, having to juggle several balls at once. Having to do, we might say, using a modern phrase, some serious multitasking. And that then is going to be our way into this text this evening. We're going to focus on this angel from verse 10 onwards, who, as I say, may well be the angel Gabriel, but may not be, we don't know for sure, and who seems to be kind of rushing madly between these different roles that he has to perform. And we're going to consider then what exactly those roles are that we see this angelic figure here performing, and there are three of them. And first of all then, the role of encourager, the role of encourager. That's one role that this angel performs. He encourages Daniel. How does he encourage Daniel? Well, you'll notice in those verses in various ways. So he encourages Daniel through a touch. Three times, actually, he touches Daniel. Verse 10, behold, a hand touched me. Verse 16, behold, one in the likeness of the children of man, same figure, I think, touched my lips, in order to get Daniel to speak in that instance. Verse 18, again, one having the appearance of a man, same figure, I think, touched me and strengthened me. So he encourages Daniel by three times touching him, but then also he encourages Daniel by using a delightful title. It's a title we came across in last week's passage, Man Greatly Loved. Did you notice that? Verse 11. And again, verse 19, he refers to Daniel by this lovely title. Of course, it's a reference to God. It's by God that Daniel is greatly loved. What an encouragement for him to hear that. And then he also encourages Daniel through a tender refrain, fear not. It's there in verse 12, and it's there again in verse 19. And so in these different ways then, this angel encourages Daniel and brings Daniel to the point where Daniel can exclaim appreciatively in verse 19, you have strengthened me. You have strengthened me. It all raises the question then, why is this strengthening, this encouragement from the angel necessary? Well, the answer is because Daniel is in a real state here. I mean, the passage is littered with references to this. So Daniel is visibly traumatized. Verse 8, he refers there in the second half of the verse, my radiant appearance was fearfully changed. He's visibly traumatized. Then again, Daniel for a time is basically comatose. Verse 9, second half of the verse. I fell on my face in deep sleep with my face to the ground. Then again, Daniel is trembling. That's mentioned twice in verse 10 and again in verse 11. Then again, Daniel is in great pain. Verse 16, he says, pains have come upon me. And it's the language normally used for a woman in labor. Then again, Daniel is drained of energy. In verse 8, he says, no strength was left in me. In verse 10, he's so devoid of energy, he can't get onto his feet. He's on his hands and knees. In verses 16 and 17, again, we have the language of strength having gone from him. Then again, Daniel is breathless. Verse 17, no breath is left in me. A kind of symptom, I guess, of what we would call a panic attack. He's unable to breathe here. And so these efforts of the angel to encourage Daniel, they're clearly not over the top. They're very necessary. Daniel is a man in pieces here. Something has dismantled him. And of course, our next question then must be, well, what? What has dismantled him? Why is Daniel in such a state? And the answer to that is because of the experience that he has had in verses 5 to 9. Because in verses 5 to 9, Daniel has an encounter. But this is a different encounter from the one he has from verse 10 onwards. This is not an encounter with the angel Gabriel. With whom is this encounter in verses 5 to 9? Whom is it that Daniel sees as he stands on the banks of the river Tigris and lifts up his eyes, verse 5? Well, I think the answer is a divine figure. This is not an angel. This is a divine figure. I mean, that's evident, is it not, from this dismantling effect that the encounter has on him. Daniel encounters angels several times in this book and isn't dismantled like this. This is something more than a mere angelic encounter. But it's also evident from the description that Daniel gives us of this person whom he sees. For one thing, there are similarities here with Ezekiel's vision in Ezekiel 1, 26 to 28. In both visions, metal, for instance, is described. In both visions, fire is described. You can look the passage up for yourself if you wish at your leisure, but we're told explicitly in Ezekiel 1 that the figure Ezekiel sees is God. It's the likeness of the appearance of the glory of Yahweh. It's God whom Ezekiel sees, and there are similarities here. And then for another thing, there are more detailed similarities with John's vision in Revelation 1, 13 to 15. Fiery eyes appear in both visions. Burnished bronze appears in both visions. A phenomenally loud voice is mentioned in both visions. And again, we're in no doubt that the figure John sees is a divine figure. It's Christ, of course. And so I'm saying it's the sight of a divine figure, it's the sight of God that literally floors Daniel here and leaves him in need of this angel's ministry of encouragement. And in view then of how much this angel has got on his plate, as we're going to see, as we proceed this evening, in view of how much this angel has got on his plate, we might think, well, what bad timing. It's a shame Daniel had to have this unnerving experience just at this point. If it hadn't happened now, then the angel could have concentrated more on his other roles and he wouldn't need to spend all these verses, 10 verses, kind of picking Daniel back up onto his feet. What a shame that the angel has to be burdened with this role. If this vision of God hadn't happened just now, then the angel could have concentrated on other roles. But actually, it's not bad timing at all. It's perfect timing. You see, one of the angel's roles, and we'll come to it, is bringing a message to Daniel. The message is summed up at the very start of our passage, verse 1 of chapter 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel. And the word was true, and it was a great conflict. Now, the message then that this angel is bringing to Daniel, which, by the way, we will come to next time, it's then set out in chapters 11 and the first part of chapter 12. This message that the angel is bringing to Daniel, it's essentially the same message as Daniel has already had in the vision in chapter 7 and in the vision in chapter 8 and in the vision in chapter 9. It's about what's going to happen over the next few hundred years, climaxing in the terrors of Antiochus the IV of Greece, Antiochus Epiphanes. Hence, it was a great conflict there in verse 1. The vision is going to be about conflict, and particularly about God's people being assaulted and attacked by enemies. But this time at greater length. This is going to be the longest vision yet. This time it's going to be really laid on thick how much God's people are going to suffer at the hands of brutal enemies. And this is a frightening message, therefore, that Daniel's going to receive from this angel. How is Daniel going to be able to cope with this? Yes, okay, it has a happy ending, but that's a long way in the distance, as we saw last Sunday evening. And the prospect then of God's people first having to go through such pain, such traumas, such persecution, worse than they've ever had to go through in the past, even in their bondage in Egypt. How is Daniel going to cope with that prospect, the prospect of rulers like Antiochus emerging on the stage of history? How is he going to be able to look at that future without sinking into utter terror? Well, this is how. Because now, after what he sees in verses 5 to 9 here, Antiochus Epiphanes won't seem all that terrifying. Antiochus Epiphanes will seem fairly puny now that Daniel has gazed upon the majesty of a much, 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 much greater king and has been truly terrified. And there's an important biblical principle here. Last summer on holiday, I heard what is probably the best sermon I've ever heard on the fear of God from Sinclair Ferguson. And he talked in the sermon about that verse that is so often misquoted, he said, in 1 John there, about, you know, perfect love casts out fear. We don't fear God because perfect love casts out fear. And he handled that. And he also kind of memorably adapted the phrase in this way. He said, actually, perfect fear casts out all other fears. That is perfect fear, the fear of God, the proper healthy fear that we should have of God. When you have that, it casts out all other fears. In other words, when you have a fear of God, you're no longer afraid of men. Fear him, you saints, we sing, don't we? And you will then have nothing else to fear. In the sermon, he referred to those Hebrew midwives. Remember that remarkable thing we're told in Exodus chapter 1, verse 17? Remember how Pharaoh has told them, if there's a Hebrew boy born, you've got to kill it. And we read in Exodus chapter 1, verse 17, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded. They feared God, and so they weren't afraid of Pharaoh. They'd seen something of the majesty of a true king, and they weren't afraid of this puny king, Pharaoh. The 17th century Bishop of Dunblane, Robert Layton, he wrote this, of this proper fear of God. He said, "This fear is not cowardice. It doth not debase, but elevates the mind. For it drowns all lower fears and begets true fortitude and courage to encounter all dangers. From this fear have sprung all the resolutions and patient sufferings of the saints and martyrs of God." This is what we need, isn't it? We need to behold our God. We need to be overwhelmed with a sense of the glory of God. I mean, it's remarkable, isn't it? The effect this vision has on Daniel. It takes an angel 10 verses to restore Daniel's equilibrium. He's so shattered by seeing God. And when we know something of that in our lives, we're ready then for the Antiochus Epiphanes of this world, aren't we? We're ready for whatever hostility may be awaiting us in the United Kingdom in the years to come. This is what we need. We need such a vision of God that we're filled with this healthy fear that makes us unfearful of the opponents and the haters of this world. So that's the first role that this angel performs, the role of encourager. But then secondly, the role of warrior. The role of warrior. Now, a bit like in chapter 9 then, this angel here comes to Daniel after Daniel has been praying. So we're told in verses 2 and 3 of Daniel fasting. He mourns for 3 weeks and eats no delicacies, no meat, no wine. We'll come back to those verses in a moment. And I know they don't actually mention prayer, but if you jump to verse 12, when the angel has come now to meet with Daniel, the angel says, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God," that's a reference to what he's been doing in verses 2 and 3, "your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words." So clearly verses 2 and 3 had included prayer. Prayer's not mentioned, but clearly amidst the fasting, Daniel had also been praying. But although this angel comes in response to Daniel's prayer, it's a delayed response. The angel delayed coming to Daniel for 21 days, for 3 weeks. And the reason then for this delay in the angel's coming is that during those 3 weeks, he has been fighting. That's made clear by what he says in verse 13. And indeed, once the angel has finally managed to pick Daniel up off his feet, as we've just been seeing in our first point this evening, you notice when you go to verse 20, he again kind of has to dash back to the fray, back to the fight. "Now I will return," he says in the middle of verse 20, "to fight." And so you see this kind of Basil Fawlty-like kind of rushing between tasks. Now he's got Daniel back up. Now he's got to dash off to fight again. So whom is he fighting? This angel. Whom is he fighting? Well, he's fighting princes. That's the language used in both verse 13 and verse 20. Initially, he's fighting the prince of Persia, and then he's going to fight the prince of Greece, he says. And if you read this passage casually, then it sounds like these are just ordinary rulers of these nations. An ordinary king of Persia, an ordinary king of Greece. But when you look more closely, that's not the case, because you notice that the same title, prince, is also used of someone else. In verse 21, verse 21 refers to your prince, that is, Israel's prince, Michael. Now, Israel has no prince called Michael, not at this point in her history, not at any other point in her history. Who is this Michael then? Well, we know who Michael is, don't we? From elsewhere in our Bibles, from Jude particularly, Jude verse 9, the archangel Michael. Michael is an angelic figure. So if Israel's prince, Michael, is an angelic figure, then presumably we are to infer that Persia's prince is also an angelic figure, and Greece's prince is also an angelic figure. Now, in order to make sense of this then, let's go back again to verses 2 and 3, where we said Daniel is mourning and he's fasting and he's not putting deodorant on and such like. Why is he doing this? Well, probably because he has heard news from back home in Jerusalem. We're told, aren't we, in the opening verses, is the third year Cyrus. Well, in the first year Cyrus, you remember, has allowed the Jews to go back home to Jerusalem. And of course, not all of them have gone. Daniel hasn't gone. Many stayed, but many did go back. And of course, they went back with this project in mind to rebuild the city and particularly to rebuild the temple. And that was an exciting project to have on the cards, except that it quickly ran into difficulties. And it seems likely then that the reason Daniel goes into a state of mourning there in verses 2 and 3, in the third year of Cyrus, is because he has heard what's going on back in Jerusalem and the difficulties into which the building project has run. Now, what are those difficulties? Why is the building project in Jerusalem experiencing difficulties? Well, we could analyze those difficulties from a political angle. And you get that perspective in the book of Ezra. If you read the book of Ezra, that's the perspective you get. The way in which, although this edict had come from the very top of the Persian hierarchy, from Cyrus himself, the temple is to be rebuilt, not all the lower levels of Persian government were on quite the same wavelength. And it took a long time for that edict from the top to filter down. And so there was opposition amongst the lower levels of Persian government to the rebuilding project. And so, as I say, you get all that kind of political analysis, if you like, in the book of Ezra, and you can study that there. But here, in our passage, in verse 13, you see, those difficulties being experienced in the building project in Jerusalem, they are analysed from quite a different angle. A profounder angle. According to this verse, behind all the political shenanigans, there's an angelic figure, or we might prefer to think of it as a demonic figure, operating through the Persian government to disrupt the building project in Jerusalem. And so Gabriel, if this is Gabriel who's chatting with Daniel here, this angel, he's saying to Daniel, look, the reason I've only come now, the reason I've been delayed these weeks, is because I've been having to deal with this demonic figure who is working through the Persian government to get at the people of God. I've been having to deal with that and fight against that demonic figure for the sake of God's people in Jerusalem. That's why I've been delayed. In fact, he says, the only reason I've been able to come to you now, Daniel, isn't because the fight has ended. It's because Michael has come to my help. And he has kind of taken over the fight for a while so that I could come and see you. Even as, he says later in verse 1 of chapter 11, even as I helped help Michael in a previous similar conflict. And so this is the intriguing perspective that we're given in Daniel 10. This intriguing angle on the problems God's people are facing in this world, particularly in Jerusalem as they're trying to rebuild the temple. Yes, there's a whole political level of explanation, but here we're given another level of explanation. It's because of demons operating through earthly powers to get at God's people. Demons who thus have to be counteracted by God's angels. It's an intriguing perspective, and I just want to infer from it a couple of things then. And like this morning, in one of them I'm on solid ground, on the other I'm being a little more tentative. And so, first of all, we're on solid ground when we say then that behind all the opposition of earthly powers to the people of God, there's satanic power at work. Behind earthly powers' opposition to the people of God, there's satanic power at work. Now, a few weeks ago, I took you to Revelation 12 and showed you that it's made quite clear there. Revelation 12 kind of gives us this perspective on the whole of Old Testament history, Why are God's people being assaulted again and again and again and again? Well, according to Revelation 12, it's not really because, you know, the Egyptians didn't like them, and then later on the Assyrians didn't like them, and then later on the Babylonians didn't like them, and so on and so on. No, it's because there's one figure who doesn't like them. It's a red dragon. It's Satan. And he is lashing out at them again and again and seeking to destroy them, and seeking to destroy them particularly so that the Messiah won't come from them. So that the pregnant woman that is Israel won't give birth to her child, Jesus, the Messiah. And really, all, in a sense, all Daniel 10 is adding to that then, is that the dragon has his minions in assaulting the people of God. He has his angels, he has his agents, he has his demons. And really then, in a sense, Daniel 10:13 is saying the same thing as Revelation 12. That behind, it's just adding another layer. Behind earthly powers' opposition, there's Satan. But in between, if you like, there's demons. Satan is getting at God's people through demons, through earthly powers. That's the chain that we can infer when we bring together Revelation 12 and Daniel 10. And of course, we should add here that in a sense, everything's changed now, because the baby that Satan was trying to stop from being born has been born, and he has done his stuff. And he has conquered Satan through his own death at the cross. And so Satan is now a conquered foe. And so in that sense, everything's changed. But in another sense, Revelation 12 goes on to show in the second half of the chapter, nothing's changed. He still assaults God's people. He does so now as a defeated foe who is on borrowed time and who is furious precisely because he's on borrowed time, but he still assaults God's people. And presumably he still does it through his demons, through earthly powers. Which is why we shouldn't be surprised when we look around the world today and we see so many earthly governments that are so entrenched in their opposition to the church. I mean, on the face of things, it seems so bizarre, doesn't it? Why should there be just so many regimes that seem tolerant of all sorts of things but utterly intolerant of the Christian gospel and the Christian church? Well, this is why. Because Satan, through his demons, is operating through these earthly powers to assault the people of God. And so we're on safe ground when we make that point. The other more tentative thing I want to infer here is this, that there seems to be then a particular demonic power, a particular demon, if you like, associated with a particular nation. Demons allocated, if you like, to particular nations. Because this angel doesn't say in verse 13, you know, verse 20, you know, I will return to fight against the prince who happens to have an association just now with Persia. No, it's the prince of Persia. This demon is particularly associated with Persia. It doesn't say, and then a prince who just now happens to have an association with Greece will come. No, it's the prince of Greece, a demon who has a very fixed association, it seems, with Greece. And I think there are other passages which perhaps support this idea. Deuteronomy 32 verse 8 is an interesting verse where we read, when the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. And sons of God, you know, is a title for angels often in the Old Testament. And that verse is saying God fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God, like he allocated nations to angelic figures. Psalm 82, I think, is even more suggestive, where you have God kind of surrounded by this council, this assembly of gods. And of course, these can't be gods, really, because there aren't any other gods. Who are these figures in Psalm 82? Angels, presumably. And yet, the way that that God speaks to them there. It's like their earthly kings in verse 3 of Psalm 82. Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Why does he address these angels like their earthly kings? Well, probably because they're particularly associated with different earthly kings. And it seems then at least arguable that the Bible teaches this idea that there can be a demon who is the prince of Persia, and there can be a demon who is the prince of Greece, and so on. But my main point here really is just this, that we need to be alive then to this whole realm that Daniel 10 is opening our eyes to. We can be so influenced by the aggressive materialism of our society, can't we? And we can feel ourselves that this just is a bit far-fetched. It's a bit ridiculous, isn't it? No, we live in a world. Remember Hamlet's words to Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our 21st century secular philosophy, and even in our evangelical philosophy, perhaps. There's a world of spirits, of angels, God's angels, Satan's angels. And Daniel 10 opens this fascinating window on a whole chunk then of Old Testament history. I mean, you think of the whole Persian period and all that we know went on there. There was the rebuilding of the temple. There was also, of course, the whole Esther saga, the Haman saga, and the attempt to wipe out God's people. And again, in the book of Esther, it's just presented as this very horizontal story. Daniel 10 is saying that throughout it all, there was Gabriel, and he and Michael were fighting against this demon associated with Persia. And the demon had the upper hand at one point, and Haman was about to wipe all God's people out. But then Michael and Gabriel, they got the victory, and God's people were spared. And it's opening up this other world to us that so often we are blind to. Think of Paul and the way he says to the Thessalonians that I tried to come to Thessalonica, to that region. Satan hindered me. You know, there are nations today, aren't there, that are closed to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we say, well, it's just because, you know, there's some very repressive Islamic regime there. And Daniel 10 is saying, no, it's because there's a prince of Iran, a prince of Saudi Arabia. There's a demonic force who is opposing the gospel there and causing that closure. And of course, it works the other way. You think of a place like Afghanistan, 25 years ago, Christians from Afghanistan could be counted on the fingers of maybe two hands. Today, thousands of Afghan Christians. And again, we can analyze it at a horizontal level, where it's because a lot of them have left Afghanistan and have become exposed to the gospel in Europe, etc., etc. And that's all true. But Daniel 10 is saying, well, who knows what transaction took place in the heavenly realm that caused suddenly this breakthrough in Afghanistan. Who knows what victory angels achieved that preceded the gospel suddenly coming to so many of those people. And so let's be alive to this whole other realm. So this busy multitasking angel, the role of encourager, the role of warrior, thirdly and very briefly, the role of messenger. And I've hinted at this all along then, that this angel, he comes to bring Daniel a message, and that message then will be set out in chapter 11 and the first part of chapter 12. But I just wanted, as we close, to alert you to the way in which the angel describes what he's about to do in chapter 11. In verse 21 of our chapter, he says, I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. What is the book of truth? Well, presumably the book of truth is just God's book setting out everything that's going to happen. It's the book we're about to sing about in a moment from Psalm 139. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. I talked on Good Friday about that script that God has written for the whole of history, and everything's in there. Every detail is in there. And is that not a wonderful thought to take with us then as we close tonight into another week with all its uncertainties from our perspective? And here's this angel saying, look, all I'm going to be telling you, Daniel, about what's going to be happening in the next few hundred years, about Antiochus Epiphanes, it's all just the contents of a book that God wrote in eternity. What will happen in your life tomorrow? Exactly what is inscribed in God's book of truth. What will happen in your life on Tuesday? Exactly what is inscribed in God's book of truth. What will happen in your life in 5 years' time? Exactly what is inscribed in God's book of truth. Nothing's random. Nothing's arbitrary. Nothing's accidental. Our lives aren't just kind of careering along in some haphazard way. There's a book of truth, and one page has been turned, and then another, and then another, and then another, until finally the last page will be turned and Jesus Christ will return in power and in glory. And it's as simple as that. And even when Antiochus's rage across the stage of history, it's just another sentence from this book of truth that God has pre-written. It's all in there. We don't need to be fazed by these things. God isn't fazed. He wrote the book. He's the author. Let's be comforted that our God has in his hands a book. In fact, it's in Jesus' hands, Revelation 5 tells us. And he's turning the pages. And he's making sure everything happens, word for word, exactly as inscribed in that book. What a comfort. Amen.